The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 8 of Discover Extra Edition contains 13 brief one-minute updates on a variety of topics from the January-February 2018 issue of Discover, plus 4 stories from the March 2018 issue covering extinction, 2 stories, antibiotics, and weight loss surgery. Famous galaxy hosts bonus black hole. Cygnus A is a galaxy famous for harboring in its center one of the most active black holes we know of. Astronomers have watched that galaxy for decades, so imagine their surprise when an observatory, New Mexico's Very Large Array, spotted a new source of radio waves, reported in June in the Astrophysical Journal. The most likely explanation? A second dormant black hole had awoken, flaming suddenly into view. The two black holes are just 1,500 light-years apart, one of the closest known pairs of supermassive black holes. They are also likely approaching each other and will eventually merge into a single entity. If our conclusion is correct, this offers a new pathway to understand the process by which large black holes coalesce in galaxy centers, says lead author Daniel Perley of Liverpool John Moores University in the UK. Valhalla or bust? Archaeologists struck gold, or at least iron, silver, and bronze, in Dysnes, a town along a northern Iceland fjord in June. 6 Viking Age graves, 2 of them boat burials, held both human and animal remains, including horses and a dog. The dig also uncovered roughly 1,000-year-old spears, swords, whetstones, and jewelry. Among sites unearthed nearby over the past century, Dysnes takes the prize for the boats, the weapons, and the size and scale and complexity, says archaeologist and dig team member Howell Roberts. Ticking time crystals. In 2012, Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek envisioned a new kind of matter based on a crystal. The ordered framework of a crystal is basically a pattern of atoms that repeats in space. In Wilczek's time crystals, motion also repeats. Imagine a material with millions of electrons, or tiny bar magnets if it's easier to picture, flipping back and forth in unison like a crystalline clock. Some physicists thought it sounded ridiculous, but now 2 groups have created versions of the matter in their labs, publishing a pair of papers in Nature in March. At the University of Maryland, 10 ytterbium ions flip around regularly, and at Harvard, it's a million nitrogen atoms. While the crystals would need to last longer, their ticking could prove a solid way to store information, even possibly serving as memory for a quantum computer. Meanwhile, we have a whole new kind of matter to explore. Lost Flight's Legacy, Stunning Seafloor Maps. In 2014, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. A massive 34-month-long international search effort found no signs of the plane. But something positive still came of it. Survey ships involved in the hunt collected an enormous amount of data about a 100,000-square-mile strip of the southeastern Indian Ocean, and researchers turned that information into high-resolution seafloor imagery. Over 85% of our world's oceans have yet to be explored in such detail, says Geoscience Australia's Kim Picard, whose team processed the data. And the MH370 search region is particularly remote and unexplored. Picard says the seafloor maps, released in July, may enable new discoveries about plate tectonics, ocean currents, and unique sea life habitats. Do you need a brain to sleep? Falling asleep, so easy you don't even need a brain. Jellyfish, brainless creatures with clusters of neurons throughout their bodies, display the same behavioral sleep traits as we do. Caltech researchers put the jellyfish Cassiopeia through a series of tests to see if they fulfilled three requirements for a sleep-like state: lowered activity levels, slower reaction times, and impaired performance after sleep deprivation. They achieved all three, according to an October paper in Current Biology. The findings indicate the behavior isn't the sole province of brains, suggesting sleep is important enough to have survived the hundreds of millions of years since we diverged from jellyfish. In fact, sleep may be an intrinsic property of neurons themselves. Fetuses track face-like shapes. Newborns tend to favor face-like patterns, such as top-heavy triangles, and researchers have now shown that third trimester fetuses have similar preferences. Lighting conditions inside the womb have only recently been explored, so despite extensive research on fetal reaction to other sensory stimuli, visual response had remained unseen until now. In a study published in June in Current Biology, developmental psychologist Vincent Reed of Lancaster University and his team carefully designed an LED array that penetrates maternal tissue, showing the fetus an image of a drifting triangle made of three red dots. When observed with a 4D ultrasound, in which a 3D image is in motion, not only were 39 fetuses able to see and track the image, but they also preferred to watch the triangle when it was top-heavy, in the face-like orientation. Researchers now aim to replicate in fetuses newborn studies that have had visual aspects. Zika kills brain cancer cells. Zika recently prompted a global health panic, but the virus could have a silver lining as an effective combatant against brain cancer in humans. Mostly spread by infected mosquitoes, the Zika virus caused near hysteria in 2015 after cases of microcephaly, which impairs brain function, were reported in infants. The condition is a result of Zika's ability to target developing brain cells in fetuses. Because it homes in on young cells, the virus may be effective against glioblastoma, a deadly form of brain cancer in adults. Zika seems to attack the still developing cells that cause glioblastoma, while leaving mature brain cells unharmed. Researchers reported in September in the Journal of Experimental Medicine that Zika extended the lives of mice with brain tumors and killed tumor cells in human brain tissue in a lab. I saw the sign. Communicating in American Sign Language takes considerable dexterity. Even the letters of the alphabet, gesticulated with one hand, require precise coordination of all five fingers. Already looking for ways to develop low-cost electronic gloves to interact with computers, University of California San Diego nanoengineer Darren Lapomi saw ASL letters as the perfect proof of concept for a smart glove. He and colleagues described the completed project in a paper in July in PLOS 1. Lapomi's glove, made entirely from off-the-shelf components at a cost of under $100, calculates joint position based on electrical fluctuations in stretch-sensitive polymers. With an accelerometer reading hand movement and a microprocessor, the glove can translate ASL letters into characters on a computer screen. For Lapomi, understanding sign language is only the first step for a glove that will soon also include tactile feedback, simulated touching. "We want the user to be able to interact with virtual objects," he explains, "to feel a cold Coke can or the biological milieu inside a virtual patient during surgical training. Pulling water from thin air. A new material can suck drinking water out of thin air, no power required. The mesh, called a metal organic framework, contains tiny spaces perfect for grabbing and holding onto water molecules. Just a couple of pounds of the stuff can draw nearly a gallon of water from the air each day, even in conditions drier than most deserts. Better yet, the sun's heat is all that's needed to retrieve the water for drinking. This makes it an attractive option for developing countries with little infrastructure. Researchers have proposed similar water collectors before, but most need electricity or high humidity to function. By further fine-tuning the tiny spaces, the project's engineers hope one day to harvest even more water. The work, led by researchers at MIT and the University of California, Berkeley, appeared in Science in April. The Moon's Magnetic Personality. New tests on a moon rock brought back by Apollo 15 reveal surprising evidence for a magnetic field baked into the rock between 1 billion and 2.5 billion years ago. Scientists knew the moon hosted a powerful magnetic field until about 3.6 billion years ago, when it seemed to abruptly shut off. But the new finding, published in August in Science Advances, extends the moon's magnetic life by more than a billion years, though at a shadow of its former self. The work of Rutgers University researcher Sonia Tiku and her team was twofold. They argon-dated the rock and separately used a magnetometer to measure the magnetic field recorded within the rock at the time it formed. Researchers speculate that one activity, perhaps Earth's tidal tug, might have powered the moon's young and strong magnetic field, while a different mechanism, such as the moon's slow cooling, could have taken over and caused the moon's dim but persistent field later on. Watery weirdness. Water is strange, says Anders Nilsson, a physicist at Stockholm University in Sweden. It expands when it cools, for example, and it has a strangely high boiling point. In a June paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Nilsson and his team described a new oddity they discovered. Water can exist in at least two distinct liquid states, each with different physical properties. It takes some coaxing to witness. Nilsson has to bring water well below its freezing point and then fiddle with the pressure, eventually resulting in a liquid that gets less dense as heat is added, proof that liquid water can take on a different physical form. Nilsson even thinks this newly discovered form of water may exist naturally in tiny shifting pockets within ordinary room temperature water. Now he's gathering more evidence. Even humble water, essential for life and thoroughly studied, still has secrets to tell. Does this dust make me look fat? Dust bunnies may be more than a nuisance that irritates your allergies and adds to your chore list. They may also be making you chubby. House dust is full of pollutants, including industrial chemicals such as bisphenol A, BPA, that can leach out from containers of household products. Researchers tested 40 substances commonly found in the home that they suspected of having some sort of impact on metabolic health, says Duke University's Christopher Casadas, a co-author of the study, published in July in Environmental Science and Technology. Although the research was limited to mouse cells in a petri dish, Casadas says the team found that two-thirds of the chemicals tested drove fat cells to develop and proliferate. However, researchers need more testing before we know the effects on humans, and if we can trade in our gym membership for a dust mop. Tubular technology. With a puff of air, this vine-inspired robot can nose itself into a number of tight situations. created by researchers at Stanford University and reported in July, the contraption is essentially a plastic tube connected to an air pump. It moves by turning itself inside out, drawing material from the inside to extend the tube farther, similar to those water snake toys from the 90s. Another version of the bot has a chamber on either side. Inflating just one enables it to turn. The tube bot's design enhances its versatility, as its outer layer remains stationary rather than needing to slide over surfaces. In early tests, the robot could extend from a compressed length of just 11 inches to over 200 feet and could carry objects inside it, such as the length of a wire to serve as an antenna or water to put out a fire. Researchers say it could search through rubble, serve as a catheter, or even deliver devices inside the body. A killer connection? New research ties mass extinctions to the rocks beneath our feet. The Trans-Antarctic Mountains split our planet's southernmost continent into east and west, at times rising more than 14,000 feet high. Today, it's a barren landscape of inhospitable rock and ice. But for scientists who hike and camp this rocky spine, it's also a portal to another Earth. Park University paleobotanist Patty Ryberg and her colleagues are uncovering the fossilized remains of a lush forest that thrived in the Antarctic Circle some 260 million years ago during the Permian period. One type of tree, called glossopterids, dominated much of a supercontinent. Then they vanished in a geological instant. The glossopterids didn't die alone. About 90% of life on Earth was snuffed out in our planet's biggest known extinction, called the Great Dying. What killed everything? Scientists have long debated the causes of this event and Earth's four other major extinctions, usually pointing to various volcanoes or asteroids. But it's tough to precisely date rocks that old, so connecting a mass extinction with one particular impact or eruption is often controversial. Now, a global campaign to map Earth's ancient mega-eruptions, paired with advances in rock dating, is pushing us closer than ever to explaining why some volcanoes and asteroids kill and others don't. Those results show that the size of an eruption or asteroid isn't as important as the type of rocks incinerated. One suspect behind several mass extinctions is a kind of enormous volcanic zone called a Large Igneous Province, or LIP. Picture a flattish, layer cake-like volcano, big enough to cover a country or a continent. Amid the seemingly endless oozing lava, its internal plumbing system rips open miles-deep cracks like something from a bombastic action flick. Every major extinction coincides with one of these eruptions. An LIP, called the Siberian Traps, formed just as the ancient forests Ryberg studies disappeared in Antarctica. Some 50 million years later, an LIP called the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province coincided with another mass extinction, one that eventually led to the rise of the dinosaurs. But while those eruptions lasted for perhaps a million years, the extinctions happened in much shorter time periods. Why? Carleton University geoscientist Richard Ernst, who has studied LIPs for two decades, launched a large-scale effort in 2010 to find answers. Although ancient LIPs are now eroded and often hard to spot, Ernst found he could map the behemoths by examining their ancient magma plumbing systems. His results were surprising. 20 previously undiscovered LIPs all over the world. Incredibly, many formed billions of years ago and left no signs of a mass extinction. By using high-tech dating techniques to examine crystals in the rock, Ernst's team has also narrowed down the timelines of these eruptions. Once we were able to start dating them, and to date them very precisely, then it was just stunning, Ernst says. His team and others can now pinpoint LIPs to within 100,000 years of their eruptions. These new discoveries also help explain what was happening at LIPs during mass extinctions. For example, as the Siberian traps formed, huge ponds of lava pooled deep underground. This magma cooked surrounding sedimentary rocks as well as enormous seams of coal. As they burned, these organic matter-rich rocks released gases like sulfur and carbon dioxide. Once the pressure below was too much, miles-deep cracks ripped open on Earth's surface, freeing the greenhouse gases. Our planetary thermostat likely rose dozens of degrees Fahrenheit. These same organics were burned and released in eruptions that wiped out Triassic life and gave rise to the dinosaurs, according to a Nature study last May. It's a very short period of time for this to build up and have such a kill mechanism for a lot of life on the planet, Ernst says. These things have a wicked climactic effect. The type of rocks burned isn't just important for mega-eruptions. A recent drilling expedition to Mexico's dino-killing Chicxulub crater, the only mass extinction conclusively linked to an impact, found the asteroid hit sedimentary rock rich in sulfurs. And a November Nature study showed such rocks cover just 13% of Earth's surface. The dinosaurs might have survived if the space rock hit elsewhere. So, really, mass extinctions often just boil down to bad luck. My lesson from this is that the Earth can go through dramatic changes, Ernst says. The planet doesn't particularly care about the biology on it, including humans. Stay the course? Researchers debate whether we should finish our antibiotic prescription. You've heard it for years. When you get antibiotics, finish the prescription, even if you feel better. Otherwise, the bug might develop antibiotic resistance, a growing problem that's making infections harder to treat. But a recent commentary in the BMJ argues that advice needs updating. Stopping the meds might be better. In Science Smackdown, we invite experts to debate both sides of the issue. The claim? Time to change the message. It's been known for decades that stopping antibiotics early doesn't cause resistance, says Martin Llewellyn, author of the BMJ paper and an infectious disease professor at Brighton and Sussex Medical School in the UK. For most of the bacteria posing threats today, it's just the opposite. Longer exposure to antibiotics increases the risk they'll develop a resistance. To curb this, Llewellyn and colleagues urge doctors to drop the complete the course rhetoric and instead advise patients to stop when they feel better. Many of the course durations that we recommend for antibiotics are probably too long for most patients, he says. The counterpoint, not just yet. Advising patients to stop their meds early is premature, says William Schaffner, a preventative medicine and infectious diseases professor at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He cites a 2016 study of children's ear infections, where a shorter antibiotic course led to relapse. Just because they were feeling better didn't mean that their infections were sufficiently treated to stop therapy, he says. He agrees with the goal of using fewer antibiotics, but he thinks rigorous studies need to be performed for each and every kind of infection before doctors change their recommendations. Rather than suggesting patients quit when they feel better, this is a call to the profession to do better studies, Schaffner says. No easy fix. A 40-year-old woman transforms her life after weight loss surgery, only to see the pounds return and her life spiral downward. Rebecca came to my clinic complaining of weight gain. This wasn't my usual case. As a gastroenterologist, I typically hear concerns over weight loss, which suggests a serious medical condition. Since adolescence, the 40-year-old had struggled physically and emotionally with obesity and eating issues. About 3 years before she landed in my office, she had a gastric bypass procedure to help her lose weight. The surgery was an unqualified success, and Rebecca, who had weighed 280 pounds, lost 120 pounds in 1 year and was maintaining her new weight. She had a slimmer appearance and a positive outlook on life. When I saw her at my clinic, however, she was depressed and near panic. She had gained 3 to 5 pounds each month over the past 6 months. The physical transformation she had made was literally vanishing before her eyes. She was struggling emotionally because of it. Bariatric surgeries, which reduce how much food someone can eat, have become more common in recent years. 3 of the procedures are an adjustable banded gastroplasty, which constricts the stomach with a flexible belt, sleeve gastrectomy, which cuts away part of the stomach, and the popular Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which involves tying off of the stomach to make it smaller. The surgeries can be quite successful. Still, the complex procedures typically involve reconstruction and rerouting of the stomach and intestines. As a result, the new connections can leak food or be too tight and block food passage. Both can lead to complications, including life-threatening infections. Moreover, patients must adopt a major lifestyle change, committing to regular exercise and a healthful diet to maintain a reduced weight. And the physical changes can set off complicated emotions, which is in part why patients undergo psychological screening. Rebecca had Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. Her stomach was tied off to create a pouch. Now the de facto stomach, the pouch, was surgically connected to the middle of her small intestine. People who have had this surgery can eat only small meals and don't feel as hungry. And since the food bypasses part of the intestines, fewer nutrients are absorbed. The result is dramatic weight loss. Sometimes I'm called upon to look for and treat problems after bariatric surgeries. Rebecca's weight gain suggested that a complication had developed from her procedure. I threaded a flexible fiber optic camera down through her esophagus and into her stomach pouch. I discovered a hole, or fistula, between her pouch and the rest of her stomach. Food was leaking through the fistula into the larger stomach, then passing through her entire small intestine. She was able to eat much more than her pouch would have allowed, and her body was absorbing everything she ate. Her weight gain made perfect sense. The procedure to fix the problem was performed the next day. Using tools passed through the endoscope and into her stomach, I closed Rebecca's fistula with metallic clips. Then we did the leak test. In the radiology department, she drank a special liquid visible under X-ray. The liquid flowed through her pouch and intestines in real time on the X-ray screen. There was no leak. I discharged Rebecca with instructions to follow up as needed. 2 months later, she was back and more anxious than before. Rebecca had gained 15 pounds since I last saw her. Assuming my closure of her fistula had come undone, I did another endoscopic investigation. I found no fistula, so I arranged to have Rebecca drink the X-ray visible liquid to find any other structural problems that could explain her weight gain. I found nothing. A week later, on a follow-up visit, Rebecca was still upset and had gained 3 more pounds. "Are you sticking to your bariatric diet?" I asked. "Yes, for sure," she told me. "Are you still exercising like you have been?" "I go for a long walk every day." After bariatric surgery, patients need to follow a highly regimented diet with appropriate vitamin supplements. Most of them eat significantly less than people who haven't had the surgery. They might consume 800 to 1500 calories per day, with many averaging about 1000 calories a day. Typical adult women consume about 2000 calories a day to maintain weight. This enables them to stay at their lower weight. Patients must avoid high-fat and calorie-dense foods, which include most junk foods. Despite her denials, I remained concerned that Rebecca was way off her diet plan. She had told me during earlier visits that binge eating was one way she dealt with stress when she was younger. I instructed her to keep a food journal and scheduled a follow-up in a month. 2 weeks later, on a Saturday, I was at a local shopping mall with family. We were standing in line at an ice cream vendor in a food court when I spotted Rebecca a few people ahead. I overheard her order a chocolate milkshake. After paying, she turned and saw me. I nodded, and she quickly averted her eyes, visibly upset. When it was my turn to order, I asked the counter person how many calories were in a milkshake. I was stunned. Over 1,300. On Monday, Rebecca showed up at my clinic. In tears, she revealed that the weight gain caused by her fistula had triggered behaviors from years ago, before her bypass surgery. She felt she was losing control over her body and appearance. Her anxiety drove her to binge eating. First, she overate solid food, but it caused her to vomit because her stomach pouch couldn't hold it all. Then, she got creative. Rebecca learned she could eat high-fat and high-calorie foods that were either liquid, such as a milkshake, or that melted in her mouth, such as cheese puffs. Her stomach pouch could handle them. After talking with Rebecca, checking an online calorie counter, and making several back-of-the-envelope calculations, I deduced that most days she was consuming over 3,500 calories. This clearly explained her weight gain. I made appointments for Rebecca with a nutritionist and a psychotherapist. With time and hard work, she was able to resume her healthful post-bariatric diet plan. The pounds started dropping off. Bariatric surgeries can truly change people's lives, but there is more to losing weight than going under the knife. "I'm very disappointed with myself," she told me. "I never thought I would be in this situation again, but I'm glad I'm back to losing weight." Schavalsky's horse, Equus schavalskii. Schavalsky's horse is almost unbelievably the last true wild species of horse left in the world. All other supposed wild horses are descended from escapees of domesticated herds. The pea horse, as it is known in rarefied scientific circles, has never been domesticated. How's that for a wild thing? This horse's downfall began when German merchant Karl Hagenbeck, who specialized in selling wild animals to zoos as well as to P.T. Barnum, captured pretty much all the wild populations of the horse. By 1945, just 31 pea horses remained in two zoos in Munich and Prague. Today, more than 1,500 individual pea horses exist. Thanks to a reintroduction program, this horse is now found on the steppes of Central Asia, and up to 300 horses gambol around in Mongolia. China's own captive breeding program has also successfully reintroduced a herd of horses into the wild. Small bands of horses in Russia and Hungary are doing well. Schavalsky's horse is now considered endangered, which is an incredible turnaround considering it had been deemed extinct in the wild up until 2008. Lord Howe Island stick insect, Dryococcalus australis. The Lord Howe Island stick insect was believed to have become extinct sometime around 1920 due to the introduction of black rats. In the 1960s, there were various reports of sightings of large stick insects on Ball's Pyramid, a rat-free rocky outcrop 14 miles from Lord Howe Island, which is off the eastern coast of Australia. In 2001, a scientific research team visited the rock and ascertained that the Lord Howe Island stick insect really was alive. Melbourne Zoo is now researching the insect's lifestyle, behavior, biology, and diet. The ultimate goal is to reintroduce the stick insect to Lord Howe Island, but the rats must be eradicated first. Then and only then does this particular critter have a chance of returning home. The eye-eye, Daubentonia madagascariensis. Coded message or not, there is a perfectly reasonable explanation for why the eye-eye has a middle finger that is so much longer, thinner, and gnarlier than any of the others. It's a percussive forager. The ai, a lemur from Madagascar, taps out a little rhythm on a wooden surface to determine where cavities are inside. Then, listening with its large disc-shaped ears, and probably using echolocation, it decides exactly where the grubs are for grub time. It uses its incisors to make a small hole in the surface, and then it inserts its especially extended digit into said hole, and presto, it pulls its dinner out of the opening, thus giving the invertebrates inside it the actual finger. And this finger is articulated by sitting on a ball and socket joint, allowing it to move and swivel a full 360 degrees. So watch out! The ai can get a hold of you wherever you are. Dexterity aside, hunting and superstition have left it endangered. This odd lemur is considered evil. Dead ai's are often hung upside down outside a village to ward off evil spirits. Several ongoing captive breeding programs have not proved successful with second-generation creatures, and the work continues. Solutions need to be found. Otherwise, we may have to say bye-bye to the ai. Tarzan's Chameleon, Coloma Tarzan. Why is this called Tarzan's Chameleon? Did Tarzan discover it? No, it is so named because it was discovered in Tarzan's Forest, just outside the village of Tarzanville, now renamed Ambodimiloka, in Madagascar in 2009. It was immediately categorized as critically endangered because slash-and-burn agriculture and illegal logging have fragmented its habitat. The Angel Shark, Squatina squatina. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, the angel shark was common from Scandinavia to Africa and all points in between. But what a difference 100 years or so can make! It has lost an estimated 80% of its population over 3 generations, and its range has shrunk to a small area around the Canary Islands. Because the angel shark lives on the bottom of the sea, it is more prone to being accidentally caught by fishing trawlers. In 2016, the Angel Shark Project developed a plan to steer the next 10 years of conservation work to ensure the future of the angel shark and its relatives, collectively, if slightly confusingly known as the angel sharks. The project's vision is to safeguard the angel shark's last stronghold in the Canaries, stabilize the population, and eventually increase angel shark numbers. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.